Unit 7.
Text 1. Beauty by Susan Sontag. For the Greeks, beauty was a virtue, a kind of excellence. Persons then were assumed to be what we now have to call, lamely, enviously, whole persons. If it did occur to the Greeks to distinguish between a person's inside and outside, they still expected that inner beauty would be matched by the beauty of the other kind. The well-born young Athenians who gathered around Socrates found it quite paradoxical that their hero was so intelligent, so brave, so honourable, so seductive, and so ugly. One of Socrates' main pedagogical acts was to be ugly and teach those innocent, no doubt splendid-looking disciples of his, how full of paradoxes life really was. They may have resisted Socrates' lesson. We do not. Several thousand years later, we are more wary of the enchantments of beauty. We not only split off, with the greatest facility, the inside, character intellect, from the outside, looks, but we are actually surprised when someone who is beautiful is also intelligent, talented, good. It was principally the influence of Christianity that deprived beauty of the central place it had in classical ideals of human excellence. By limiting excellence, virtus in Latin, to moral virtue only, Christianity set beauty adrift as an alienated, arbitrary, superficial enchantment. And beauty has continued to lose prestige. For close to two centuries, it has become a convention to attribute beauty to only one of the two sexes, the sex which, however fair, is always second. Associating beauty with woman has put beauty even further from the defensive, morally. A beautiful woman, we say in English, but a handsome man. Handsome is the masculine equivalent of, and refusal of, a compliment which has accumulated certain demeaning overtones by being reserved for women only. That one can call a man beautiful in French and Italian suggests that Catholic countries, unlike those countries shaped by the Protestant version of Christianity, still retain some vestiges of the pagan admiration for beauty. But the difference, if one exists, is of degree only. In every modern country that is Christian or post-Christian, women are the beautiful sex, to the detriment of the notion of beauty as well as of women. To be called beautiful is thought to name something essential to the woman's character and concerns, in contrast to men whose essence is to be strong or effective or competent. It does not take someone in the throes of advanced feminist awareness to perceive that the way women are taught to be involved with beauty encourages narcissism, reinforces dependence and immaturity. Everybody, women and men, knows that. For it is everybody, a whole society, that has identified being feminine with caring about how one looks. In contrast to being masculine, which is identified with caring about what one is and does, and only secondarily, if at all, about how one looks. Given these stereotypes, it is no wonder that beauty enjoys, at best, a rather mixed reputation. It is not, of course, the desire to be beautiful that is wrong, but the obligation to be or to try. What is accepted by most women as a flattering idealization of their sex is a way of making women feel inferior to what they actually are or normally grow to be. For the ideal of beauty is administered as a form of self-oppression. Women are taught to see their bodies in parts and to evaluate each part separately. Breasts, feet, hips, waistline, neck, eyes, nose, complexion, hair, and so on. Each in turn is submitted to an anxious, fretful, often despairing scrutiny. Even if some pass muster, some will always be found wanting. Nothing less than perfection will do. In men, good looks is a whole, something taken in at a glance. It does not need to be confirmed by giving measurements of different regions of the body. Nobody encourages a man to dissect his appearance feature by feature. As for perfection, that is considered trivial, almost unmanly. Indeed, in the ideally good-looking man, a small imperfection or blemish is considered positively desirable. According to one movie critic, a woman, who is a declared Robert Redford fan, it is having that cluster of skin-coloured moles on one cheek that saves Redford from being merely a pretty face. Think of the depreciation of women, as well as of beauty, that is implied in that judgment. The privileges of beauty are immense, said Cocteau. To be sure, beauty is a form of power, and deservedly so. What is lamentable is that it is the only form of power that most women are encouraged to seek. This power is always conceived in relation to men. It is not the power to do, but the power to attract. It is a power that negates itself, for this power is not one that can be chosen freely, at least not by women, or renounced without social censure. To preen, for a woman, can never be just a pleasure. It is also a duty. It is her work. If a woman does real work, and even if she has clambered up to a leading position in politics, law, medicine, business, or whatever, she is always under pressure to confess that she still works at being attractive. But insofar as she is keeping up with one of the fair sex, she brings under suspicion her very capacity to be objective, professional, authoritative, thoughtful. Damned if they do, women are, and damned if they don't. One could hardly ask for more important evidence of the dangers of considering persons as split between what is inside and what is outside than that interminable, half-comic, half-tragic tale, The Oppression of Women. How easy it is to start off by defining women as caretakers of their services and then to disparage them, or find them adorable, for being superficial. It is a crude trap, and it has worked for too long. But to get out of the trap requires that women get some critical distance from that excellence and privilege which is beauty. Enough distance to see how much beauty itself has been abridged in order to prop up the mythology of the feminine. There should be a way of saving beauty from women and for them. Text 2. Sexism in English, A Feminist View, by Aline Pace Nielsen. Does culture shape language? Does language shape culture? This is as difficult a question as the old puzzler of which came first, the chicken or the egg, because there's no clear separation between language and culture. A well-accepted linguistic principle is that as culture changes, so will the language. The reverse of this, as a language changes, so will the culture, is not so readily accepted. This is why some linguists smile, or even scoff, at feminist attempts to replace Mrs. and Miss with Ms., and to find replacements for those all-inclusive words which specify masculinity, for example, chairman, mankind, brotherhood, freshman, etc. Perhaps they are amused for the same reason, that it is the doctor at a cocktail party who laughs the loudest at the joke about the man who couldn't afford an operation, so he offered the doctor a little something to touch up the x-ray. A person working constantly with language is likely to be more aware of how really deep-seated sexism is in our communication system. Last winter, I took a standard desk dictionary and gave it a place of honour on my night table. Every night that I didn't have anything more interesting to do, I read myself to sleep, making a card for each entry that seemed to tell something about male and female. By spring, I had a rather dog-eared dictionary, but I also had a collection of note cards filling two shoeboxes. The cards tell me some rather interesting things about American English. First, in our culture, it is a woman's body which is considered important, while it is a man's mind or his activities which are valued. A woman is sexy. A man is successful. I made a card for all the words which came into modern English from somebody's name. I have a 2.5-inch stack of cards, which are men's names now used as everyday words. The women's stack is less than 0.5-inch high, and most of them came from Greek mythology. Words coming from the names of famous American men include Lynch, Sousaphone, Sideburns, Pullman, Rickettsia, Schicktest, Winchester Rifle, Franklin Stove, Bartlett Pear, Teddy Bear, and Boysenberry. The only really common words coming from the names of American women are Bloomers, after Amelia Jenks Bloomer, and Mae West Jacket. Both of these words are related in some way to a woman's physical anatomy. while the male words, except for Sideburns after General Burnside, have nothing to do with the namesake's body. This reminded me of an earlier observation that my husband and I made about geographical names. A few years ago, we became interested in what we call topless topography. When we learned that the Grand Tetons used to be simply called the Tetons by French explorers and the Teats by American frontiersmen. We wrote letters to several mapmakers and found the following listings. Nippletop and Little Nippletop near Mount Marcy in the Adirondacks. Nipple Mountain in Archuleta County, Colorado. Nipple Peak in Coke County, Texas. Nipple Butte in Pennington, South Dakota. Squaw Peak in Placer County, California, and many other places. Maiden's Peak and Squaw Tit, they're the same mountain, in the Cascade Range in Oregon. Jane Russell Peaks near Stark, New Hampshire, and Mary's Nipple near Salt Lake City, Utah. We might compare these names to Jackson Hole, Wyoming, or Pike's Peak, Colorado. I'm sure we would get all kinds of protests from the Jackson and Pike descendants if we tried to say that these topographical features were named because they in some way resembled the bodies of Jackson and Pike, respectively. This preoccupation with women's breasts is neither new or strictly American. I was amused to read the derivation of the word Amazon. According to Greek folk etymology, the A means without, as in atypical or amoral, while mazon comes from mazos, meaning breast. According to the legend, these women cut off one breast so that they could better shoot their bows. Perhaps the feeling was that the women had to trade in part of their femininity in exchange for their active or masculine role. There are certain pairs of words which illustrate the way in which sexual connotations are given to feminine words, while the masculine words retain a serious business-like aura. For example, being a call boy is perfectly respectable. It simply refers to a person who calls actors when it is time for them to go on stage, but being a call girl is being a prostitute. Also, we might compare sir and madam. Sir is a term of respect, while madam has acquired the meaning of a brothel manager. The same thing has happened to the formerly cognate terms master and mistress. Because of its acquired sexual connotations, mistress is now carefully avoided in certain contexts. For example, the Boy Scouts have scout masters, but certainly not scout mistresses. And in a dog show, the female owner of a dog is never referred to as the dog's mistress, but rather as the dog's master. Master appears in such terms as master plan, concert master, schoolmaster, mix master, master charge, master craftsman, etc., but mistress appears in very few compounds. This is the way it is with dozens of words which have male and female counterparts. I found 200 such terms, for example, usher, usherette, heir, heiress, hero, heroine, etc. In nearly all cases, it is the masculine word which is the base, with a feminine suffix being added, for the alternate version. The masculine word also travels into compounds, while the feminine word is a dead end. For example, from king, queen, comes kingdom, but not queendom. From sportsman, sportslady, comes sportsmanship, but not sportsladyship, etc. There is one, and only one, semantic area in which the masculine word is not the base or more powerful word. This is in the area dealing with sex and marriage. Here, it is the feminine word which is dominant. Prostitute is the base word, with male prostitute being the derived term. Bride appears in bridal shower, bridal gown, bridal attendant, bridesmaid, and even in bridegroom, while groom, in the sense of bridegroom, does not appear in any compounds, not even to name the groom's attendants or his prenuptial party. At the end of a marriage, this same emphasis is on the female. If it ends in divorce, the woman gets the title of divorcee, while the man is usually described with a statement, such as, he's divorced. When the marriage ends in death, the woman is a widow, and the er suffix, which seems to connote masculine, probably because it is an agentive or actor-type suffix, is added to make widower. Widower doesn't appear in any compounds, except for grass widower, which is another companion term. But widow appears in several compounds, and in addition has some acquired meanings, such as the extra hand dealt to the table in certain card games, and an undesirable leftover line of type in printing. If I were an anthropological linguist making observations about a strange and primitive tribe, I would duly note on my tape recorder that I found linguistic evidence to show that in the area of sex and marriage, the female appears to be more important than the male, but in all other areas of the culture, it seems that the reverse is true.
Listening in and speaking out. The Importance of Being Interested, Part 2, by H. Addington Bruce. Take similarly the history of an English lad born some 20 years after Franklin died. More happily circumstanced, being the son of a successful physician, this boy was given all the advantages of good schooling. But he did not seem to draw much profit from his lessons. In fact, as he himself has told us, both his father and his teachers were inclined to regard him as rather below the common standard in intellect. To make matters worse, from the father's point of view, he showed a marked distaste for the tasks of the schoolroom, and an equally marked fondness for wandering about. Gun in hand, he would roam for hours through verdant lanes or across the open country. You care for nothing but shooting, dogs, and rat-catching, and you will be a disgrace to yourself and all your family, his father once predicted mournfully. As the boy grew older, his propensity for idling seemed only to increase. In spite of this, hoping against hope that he would settle down to serious things, his father entered him at the University of Glasgow, with the idea of fitting him for the practice of medicine. "It is no use," the boy frankly admitted after a few months at Glasgow. "I hate the work here, and I cannot possibly be a physician." So earnest were his protests that he transferred to Cambridge University, on the understanding that he would study to be a clergyman. At Cambridge, as good fortune would have it, he entered the natural history class of an eminent and enlightened scholar, Professor Henslow, who sent him into the woods and fields to make collections of plants and insects. Free again to roam under the clear blue skies, but this time with a lofty purpose set before his mind, a passion for achievement took possession of him. The boy, whom other teachers had found dull and lazy, proved himself, under Professor Henslow's inspiring guidance, a marvel of industry and mental vigor. There was no longer any thought of the last resort plan of putting him into the ministry. He would, he assured his now delighted father, devote his whole life to the study of nature's laws. Thus it came about that when his college days were over, he eagerly accepted an opportunity to accompany a government exploring expedition. During that long voyage in southern seas, he accumulated a remarkable collection of specimens. What was far more important, he brought back with him to England, after a 5 years' absence filled with hardships, a mass of new ideas regarding fundamental principles in natural science. Ideas which, being masterfully scrutinized and sifted, were afterwards to make him world-famous as Charles Darwin, originator of the doctrine of evolution. Now, I have recalled these beginnings of the careers of Franklin and Darwin, because they strikingly illustrate a profound psychological truth, the significance of which can scarcely be overestimated. Stated briefly, the truth in question is that success in life, meaning thereby the accomplishment of results of real value to the individual and to society, depends chiefly on sustained endeavor springing out of a deep and ardent interest in the tasks of one's chosen occupation. It is not enough merely to be a hard worker. The world is full of people who slave faithfully at their respective duties, perhaps earn a handsome living, but know in their hearts that they have failed to achieve their possibilities. Yet, the trouble with them simply is that they are not really interested in what they are doing. It may be stated as a well-established fact that intense interest plus persistent effort is the prime essential to the highest success in any sphere of human activity. She wondered